one total war. If you tell somebody that today, they would just shake their head and say, right, were they all drunk or what? What was it that made those people shout like that? At that moment, I found him terrible, frightening. But then I repressed it again. American participants described the overheated and aggressive atmosphere at appearances by Donald Trump during his election campaign in similar terms. But his excesses, as conveyed by the world's media, have met with surprisingly little rage in the country that once exported its model of liberal democracy to the European post-war world. As if no one wanted to imagine that Trump, who had been dismissed as a political clown, would make it to the Oval Office. It's not impossible that his victory surprised even Trump himself in the end, and we cannot rule out the possibility of similar surprises in the same vein. In his tightly scripted victory speech, Trump said that he had led a movement on the way to the presidency. By saying this, he was suggesting subliminally that he essentially refused to acknowledge the democratic institutions. The reference to a movement among the people has been a concept often used by authoritarian leaders to escape the control of democratic authorities. Only incorrigible inhabitants of Cloud Cuckoo Land can seriously believe that now, in possession of such great power, he will allow those powers who were unable to prevent him from marching all the way to the White House to put the thumbscrews on him, Richard Herzinger warned in Die Welt. Even if, because of the system of checks and balances in the American Constitution, Trump presents himself in a more moderate light than he said he would, he has contaminated the political climate in his country for years, if not decades. The losers of the American dream were in search of a scapegoat, and Donald Trump has given them that scapegoat. In his view, Muslims, Latin Americans, and the Chinese, in fact, migrants in general, are responsible for leaving the white middle class behind and taking their jobs. Next in line for condemnation is globalization. America has, for the first time, a president whose declaration of war on the democratic establishment has an extraordinary effect on right-wing populists in Europe, because they sense a chance to do the same, and eventually to introduce a return to nationalism. The political scientist, Albrecht von Lucke, has summed up Trump's notions of democracy. Trump's friend-enemy ideology, his emphasis on internal politics and rejection of the international stage, has led him to the most serious problem that also explains the jubilation on the part of the European populists. Trump might only become the spearhead of a new form of democracy that no longer sees itself in a pluralist and diverse sense, but ethnically homogeneous. Viktor Orban has also gauged the actual dimension of the election in his own terms when he invented a victory of true democracy. What appears here is a different form of democracy, without a constitutional state and without an opposition. Von Lucke fears that in these democracies the will of the people is being realized by a charismatic leader, entirely in the spirit of the old Nazi motto, one people, one Reich, one Führer. In Europe, this development has fallen on fertile ground. The current campaign by right-wing populists in the Western world is successful because they can fight for and win over the socially left behind, while the bourgeois middle class slumbers like Sleeping Beauty, unable to interpret the dangers of a fragmented society that has lost its solidarity. Anxiety and ignorance seem to be responsible for the fact that the number of drowned refugees leaves us cold and makes us close borders and watch as the hatred of the right takes effect. These events appear to herald a rerun of the darkest period of humanity's history. The political indifference that Brunhilde Pomsel describes in the milieu that shaped her in the smart district of Berlin-Südende can also be found today among the predominantly helpful Germans. They reacted without particular protest to the demonstrations of the Pegida movement, which at the peak of its popularity, as in a rally in Dresden, the Turkish-German speaker, Akif Pirinçici, stirred up the population in a spirit of hatred and the human dignity of Muslims was publicly insulted. It was perhaps only when Brunhilde Pomsel missed her Jewish neighbor Rosa Lehmann Oppenheimer's soap that she became aware of what was going on around her. When her Jewish friend Eva Löwenthal disappeared in 1943, Brunhilde Pomsel could have known that Jews weren't simply being resettled in the East and that concentration camps were not merely being used to re-educate people who were critical of the regime, as propaganda wanted to make people believe, according to her account. But she didn't know. Pomsel should interest us because she draws our attention to something ourselves, our anxieties, our arrogance, and our disdain for a freedom that has been fought for in a difficult and bloody struggle, and a misunderstanding of how unity breaks down and brutalization occurs in times of globalization. Until Hitler's seizure of power, no one in the Pomsel family was prejudiced against the Jews. Pomsel describes her circle of friends at the age of 22 as an apolitical clique of spoilt boys. One has an image in front of one's eyes, the boys in white shirts, with braces or in jackets, in heavy leather shoes, their hair combed neatly to the side, gathering with the girls in their fashionable dresses. All a bit more elegant than the average Berliner. A motorbike was a sensation. The beer shared in the pub was a compensation and escape in a time of economic decline and political upheaval. Only very few people had a telephone. Only adults read the newspapers, radio and television were still in the developmental stage. The modern age was still only just beginning, and politics was completely uninteresting to the clique. There were no Jews in her circle of friends. Her close friend Eva Löwenthal was an exception. Before 1933, nobody thought about the Jews anyway. It was all invented by the Nazis later on. It was only National Socialism that made us aware that they were different people. Later, that was all part of the planned program for the extermination of the Jews. We had nothing against Jews. On the contrary, my father was very glad to have some Jewish customers because they had the most money and always paid well. We played with the children of the Jews. There was one girl, Hilde. She was nice. And next door I remember a Jewish child my age, and I played with him sometimes, and then there was our Rosa Lehmann Oppenheimer. I remember her too. So it never occurred to us that there was anything wrong with them. When we were growing up, nothing at all. And when National Socialism came closer and closer, we still didn't understand what might come. And we waved at our beloved Führer, and why not? First people wanted work and money. We had lost everything in the war, and the Versailles Treaty defrauded us, we were later taught. None of us had any idea what was coming our way with Hitler. If Brunhilde Pomsel claims not to have understood in advance what Adolf Hitler's seizure of power would mean, today, in the age of the mass media and the internet, that is no longer possible, or barely, in any Western society. Every negative spin, almost every speech, every new bit of taboo-busting by the right-wing populists goes globally viral on the internet, is passed on unquestioningly on social networks, and is permanently stored. It has been proven for a long time that Facebook and other platforms have become the central medium for radicalization and mobilization. Even so, Facebook denies any responsibility for the distribution of hate posts and propaganda. Independent of any truth content, the Facebook algorithm provides everything the radical heart could crave, reinforcing prejudices and confirming the user's existing worldview. The internet is becoming a medium for spewing out hatred, since the elements of discontent can come together more easily than before. Right-wing populists understand that they can reach a big public on the internet without journalists using an old strategy like the one used by the National Socialists, namely, defaming the press as the lying press, a concept that Joseph Goebbels used to denounce his critics. Conversely, right-wing populists in the present day are aiming for a de-rationalization of reality. Post-truth, the word of the year in 2016, is a term for the strategy of right-wing populists to gain support by spreading lies and whipping up hysteria. Donald Trump's election campaign would have been much less successful without the defamation of the press and the distribution of the supposed truth via social media, whose networks provide a refuge in which users can uninhibitedly exchange thoughts and information with like-minded people. The right-wing populists know how to make unrestrained use of mistrust for the purpose of agitation. The conspiracy theories surrounding the consequences of the financial crisis, as well as the fear of globalization and growing numbers of refugees, are employed to seduce people who feel that their situation is precarious. Young people tend not to use conventional sources for information. A study of 90,000 Austrians reached the shattering conclusion that 85% of those aged between 80 and 35 distrust the traditional media. No less impressive is a study carried out for the Trust Barometer between 2015 and 2016. The global PR agency Edelman questioned over 30,000 people from a total of 28 countries around the world about their trust in elites. And in more than half of countries in Europe, the general public's trust in politics, the economy, and not least the media, has fallen to a level below 50%. In Europe, a justified concern is growing that the spread of fake reports and lies on the internet could massively influence elections, a topic much discussed after the election of the 45th US president. Quite rightly, too, because Trump's advocates, including the online magazine Breitbart News Network, which has been described as racist, have spread fake reports over the internet that stir up feelings against Muslims and other minorities. Breitbart also reported all kinds of rumors about presidential candidate Hillary Clinton, presenting them as facts. Clinton was not only attacked because of the email scandal and was described as a money-grabbing puppet of Wall Street, but in spite of accusations that were refuted long ago, she was also held responsible for the attack on the American consulate in Benghazi in Libya on the 11th of September 2012. In addition, there were rumors of a new sex scandal involving her husband Bill Clinton, even though no proof was provided. In Germany, too, media outlets such as Compact magazine very successfully spread crude conspiracy theories, which are in every respect a match for Trump's. Compact speaks of the deliberate Umvölkung, ethnic cleansing of the German people by migrants. Democratically legitimate parties are defamed as traitors to the people. Or unexamined news items are put out about rapes that are supposed to have been committed by refugees. These are later revealed as lies, but can still spread their power like wildfire. Nothing is sacred to right-wing populists, and as in the United States, the strategy of rabble-rousing and fake reports can bear fruit, because what Joseph Goebbels could only circulate via radio and film can acquire much greater power on the internet. Brunhilde Pomsel remembers in her own way the beginning of escalating rabble-rousing, which would later lead to the mass murder of Jews. But how? What? Why? We didn't know. Until that terrible business in November 1938, the night of the Reich pogrom. We were all shocked that such a thing could happen. That they should have beaten up Jewish people, people of any kind, and that they had broken the windows of Jewish shops and taken things out. In all parts of the city. Well, yes, that's where it all really began. We were shaken awake. And then somebody, a friend or relative, said that somewhere neighbors had been taken away by people in uniform. They collected them and drove them away in trucks. Where to? No one knew. Of course that was shocking for everyone, who had never paid much attention to politics, and that included us. Terrible. Is our present-day passive horror enough to resist the creeping radicalization of parts of the population against minorities? The terrible events described by Brunhilde Pomsel, which were impossible to resist in those days because the dictatorship was in complete control of everything, had been preceded by a slow process of agitation. The Nazis also started with defamation and propaganda against the Jews before anti-Jewish laws were introduced after the seizure of power, and in the end, there was open persecution after the state-ordained Reich pogrom night, which encountered no resistance from the German population. In 2016, Donald Trump's populist rhetoric actually revives memories of the darkest times, because the mechanisms and effects of stirred-up hatred are the same as during the rise of the Nazi dictatorship. If the number of attacks on Muslims rose briefly at first after the assault on the World Trade Center on the 11th of September 2001, the authorities were able to identify a subsequent fall-off in such incidents. Even before Donald Trump's election victory, it was feared that the number of crimes committed against minorities and particularly against Muslims would rise again. In fact, the number of hate crimes in the United States leapt after Election Day, 8th of November 2016. The Southern Poverty Law Center recorded over 900 reports of harassment and possible hate crimes immediately after Trump's election. A mixture of fear, passivity, and ignorance about right-wing populists also left the people of Britain shocked once they became aware of the consequences of Brexit, and the number of criminal attacks on foreigners multiplied the day after the referendum. Only a few days after the British voted to leave the European Union, the Metropolitan Police provided figures that demonstrate a direct correlation with pre-Brexit propaganda primarily directed against Eastern European immigrants. In London alone, between the vote on 23rd of June and the end of July 2016, there were over 2,000 racially motivated attacks. While Polish citizens in the UK were themselves affected by racism, on the 11th of November 2015, far-right organizations had demonstrated in Poland against Warsaw's proposal to take in refugees, chanting, "Poland for the Poles." Participants in the march were not only typical nationalists, but also people who had been assumed to belong to the political center. In Germany, a wave of xenophobia assumed dramatic form as long ago as the 1990s, with fatal attacks on asylum seekers, refugees. These included the sieges of hostels in Hoyerswerda in 1991 and Rostock-Lichtenhagen in 1992, as well as the deadly attacks on families of Turkish origin in Mölln in 1993 and Solingen in 1996, in which a total of 8 people lost their lives. Since the refugee crisis, the mood in Germany has worsened. The Amadeo Antonio Foundation and Pro Asyl, in a chronicle that covered only the year 2015, registered 1,072 attacks on refugee hostels, including 136 arson attacks. A total of 267 people were injured. The rise in these incidents is particularly concerning against the background of the rise of the AfD, which, with its xenophobic slogans and a direct connection with the Pegida movement, helped right-wing acts of violence achieve record levels. The figure for these attacks in 2016 was more than 44% higher than the previous year. These are exclusively attacks in which people are harmed or could have lost their lives when stones and firebombs are thrown at their hostels, or they are attacked with pistols and explosives. But in comparison to the 1990s, there are very few counter-protests against these attacks. Under the Nazi dictatorship, Brunhilde Pomser's only possible response to the developments was to take horrified note of them. But what about us now? In the 1990s, after the attacks in Mölln and Solingen, for weeks at a time, concerts and candlelit demonstrations showed a country that refused to accept this form of prejudice. In Frankfurt alone in December 1992, 150,000 people took part in a concert with the motto, "Heute die, morgen du." Them today, you tomorrow. In Munich on the 6th of December 1992, more than 400,000 people took to the streets and formed a candlelit procession against xenophobia and the far right. And today? Is the cozy lethargy of the moderate bourgeoisie not partly responsible for the fact that in 2016, the German Federal Criminal Office anxiously expects further serious right-wing acts of violence? In regard to the new bogeyman of the refugee, the otherwise very divided far-right movement seems to have reached a far greater consensus than that achieved by what we may still assume to be the overwhelming majority of people attached to the democratic structure. Can a society with democratic principles afford to allow opponents of a new home for asylum seekers in Klausnitz in central Saxony to block the provision of accommodation for refugees? The pictures have been seen on the internet all over the world. About 100 demonstrators blocking a bus full of refugees as it attempted to reach a hostel and chanting, "We are the people." They prevented the passengers from leaving the bus so that the frightened refugees from war zones could only be brought to safety with the help of the police. Can we afford to wait until, like Josef Goebbels' secretary, we only watch the terrible events in silent horror before getting on with the business of the day? If we think about Hitler and the Third Reich, the Holocaust is presumably still the greatest act of barbarism of all time. But the history of National Socialism began long before that. The first attempted putsch was in 1923, and the Nazi facade and ideology were built up step by step. Even if, in her safe little world, Brunhilde Pomsel showed no interest in the political development of her country, it was still insidiously taking place. Anyone who dares to make comparisons with the present day is not relativizing Nazism. It is not a comparison in the sense of a one-to-one match. It is a matter of recognizing signs of the danger of new radical trends in the present. And those signs taken altogether are grave enough. Right-wing populists are once again awakening the lowest instincts in the population by portraying particular groups of people as inferiors. In the end, people hate other people as a way of feeling better about themselves in the absence of any sense of self-worth. Contempt and hatred become collective self-empowerment. the willingness of populists to resort quite openly to racist rhetoric or to threaten their political opponents with their removal can be shown with reference to their inflammatory speeches. In December 2015, Donald Trump, to thunderous applause from his supporters, advocated a travel ban for Muslims and a short time later, racial profiling. That is, action by the police against people who are held to be suspicious on the basis of their skin color, religion, nationality, or ethnic origin, and the possibility of arrest on those grounds. In October 2016, the parliamentary party leader of the IFD, Björn Höcke, called for the removal of elites. "We have a completely exhausted old elite, as I call it. We don't just have old parties, we have old media, we have an old elite. Some things will need to be cleared away in this country, and this old elite is so exhausted that it has to go. We will have to dispose of the old elite." His exhortation fatally recalls a speech given by Joseph Goebbels in July 1932, a good 6 months before the Nazi seizure of power in a radio broadcast. "We do not need to negotiate with parties and systems hostile to us except insofar as we want to remove them." Less than a year later, the National Socialists came to power and began removing their political opponents. In January 2017, to frantic cheers from his supporters, Höcke upped the ante when he referred, among other things, to the Holocaust Memorial in Berlin. "We Germans, our people, are the only people in the world that has planted a monument of shame in the heart of its capital." He was not only kicking out at the memory of the 6 million murdered Jews and those from other marginalized groups, but was relativizing the most serious crime against humanity in history. In September 2015, Marine Le Pen used the refugee policy of the German Chancellor Angela Merkel to consolidate her ambitions for the French presidency. In a speech in Brussels, she declared that the sovereignty of the EU countries was threatened by an enemy who is working and plotting only a few streets away from here. She meant the Euro-dictatorship of the European Commission. The Commission, she argued, was trying to conceal its true nature. A machine for crushing peoples, a sower of austerity, and now a receptionist of all the illegals on the planet. If one is inclined on the basis of Brunhilde Pomser's biography to condemn her, the question naturally arises whether our behavior in the present day is so very different from that of the people in the Third Reich. Have we not reached a much more dramatic form of ignorance and apathy if such inflammatory speeches have no consequences even though we know where they can lead? Unlike the generation that saw Adolf Hitler or Benito Mussolini as the salvation from economic misery, or at least tacitly agreed when they assumed power, because of our knowledge of history, we are aware of the consequences of such a dictatorship. In her reflections, however, Pomser sees today's youth as far less ignorant and naive. "Politics was largely uninteresting as far as we were concerned. When I see what schoolgirls get up to today, expressing their opinions and everything, I think to myself, my God, that's a difference. That's an incredible difference. Then I sometimes think, I'm not over 100 years old, I'm 300 years old. Their whole way of life is completely different." But in a 2016 survey, not even a fifth of all German and Austrian young people said they were interested in politics at all. Today's young people are not the first generation to have grown up largely apolitical. The same applies to Generation Y, born between 1980 and the turn of the millennium. Former Daimler CEO Ezard Reuter insists that the generation is completely unprepared for the crisis of the present, as they have never been interested in politics, and even holds them responsible for the rise of the populists, who have had an easy ride since all they had to do was construct threatening scenarios whose contents were never examined. The generation of 1968 got a lot of things wrong, but they always argued, got engaged, and involved. The former head of Daimler doesn't say this without putting some of the responsibility on the democratic elites. Political debate is an indispensable element of any democracy. Controversies are only staged for the next round of elections, while genuine problems aren't addressed. No wonder young people don't think anyone's telling them the truth. According to a survey by the University of Konstanz, fewer and fewer students in Germany are taking an interest in politics. If we look closely at the opinion polls, we can identify a trend towards political apathy and passivity. A majority of respondents are chiefly concerned with their own future and career. They hope that their studies will give them not only good training, but also an interesting job as well as a decent income. These findings are very similar to those of the 17th Shell Youth Study, which shows that most young people are primarily concerned about their individual happiness and a materially secure future, and barely take any interest in politics and the common good. In the United States, the figures don't look very different. In September 2008, 65% of 18 to 29-year-olds said they took an interest in elections, and by September 2012, this had fallen to 48%. And while in 2008, 72% claimed they had decided to vote, this had declined in 2012 to 63%. The political indifference of the younger generation is also apparent from the referendum on the departure of the UK from the European Union. Young Britons who were eligible to vote on the 23rd of June 2016 but didn't admitted with horror that they hadn't expected the result. They had simply assumed that those in favour of remaining in the EU would win in any case. The fact that they complained the following day about the loss of the advantages of being in the EU is a direct consequence of political indifference, because they could have influenced the result in their favour by making use of their right to vote. For a large proportion of the younger generation, the need for self-expression is at the centre of everyday activity. The perfect stage for that is the internet, with its platforms like Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, to satisfy their hunger for self-promotion. Something once done only by those in the colourful pages of glossy magazines is now imitated by millions of young people on the internet. However, anyone who criticises the younger generation, as Edzard Reuter has, mustn't ignore the fact that the young face all kinds of insecurities. Their relationship with the world of work is increasingly precarious, and since 9/11, they have been confronted with the threat of terrorism like no other generation since the Second World War. Yet in two respects, they are distinctly at an advantage compared to the youth of the 1930s. They have had a far better education, and they have grown up with the concept of universal human rights. But it is also true that in spite of their education, many of the young barely have a chance of genuine participation. In Europe, this applies particularly to countries such as Greece, Spain, or Portugal, where since the financial crisis of 2008 and the subsequent euro crisis, youth unemployment has hit record levels, and also parts of East Germany. It is beyond dispute that many of the young in Europe and the United States have no positive expectations of the future. They are the first generation since the Second World War that fears that they won't be able to achieve or maintain the standard of living and the quality of life enjoyed by their parents, says the sociologist Zygmunt Bauman. This produces anger and hatred on one hand, and on the other, a lack of interest in politics, as well as resignation at not being able to improve their own situation through political engagement. Even if many young people seem different today, modern, networked, and well-educated, a good number are as apolitical, resigned, or indifferent as Brunhilde Pomsel in her day, and just as preoccupied with themselves as the clique she describes. The young in Western democracies after 9/11 did not grow up in authoritarian conditions, but they did grow up with uncertainty and insecurity. Knowing the history of the 20th century, their interest should be in the preservation of democracy. And to do that, online petitions would hardly be enough. Great waves of rage on the internet have no consequences for society, because this kind of protest has few political or social consequences, although the same cannot be said of rabble-rousing by demagogues. A statement in favour of an environmental protection project or against intensive farming leads to no obligations of any kind for its signatories. Activities such as online petitions fit with the general image of this generation, involving only fleeting involvement, and are essentially no different from hedonistic consumerism. All too often, it looks as if political activity is little more than a refined form of consumerism, which is chiefly popular with the affluent who can present their identity relatively simply and show what a good cause they have chosen, as the British political scientist Jerry Stoker observes in his book, Why Politics Matters. The condemnation inherent in this statement should perhaps be viewed with scepticism, but its negative effect may be relevant for the maintenance of a democratic order. The problem of every analysis of a generation is that it is conducted with the aspirations and value judgments of an earlier generation. From this point of view, Brunhilde Pomsel views the contemporary situation of young people in comparison with her own time and confuses the present generation's technical advances and greater access to knowledge with greater interest and political activity. We were stupid in those days. There wasn't time to think about everything. Ordinary people would be thinking about when they had to go to work. In my circle, we were largely untouched by problems. They didn't burden or preoccupy us the way they preoccupy me now that my life is behind me. I'm much more interested in them now. I'm just trying to explain to you how, as a young person who is simply released into life, there seems to be some kind of direction, but it doesn't always need to be an influence. That's easier to observe in the present day. In Europe, the possibility of an active peace movement among the younger generation of the kind seen in the days of the nuclear threat between East and West is very remote. In spite of a precarious labor market, a rise in far-right activism in the streets, mass attacks on refugees, and terrible civil wars like the one being waged in Syria, large numbers of the younger generation seem resigned or indifferent. Brunhilde Pomsel also did not reflect upon the political situation of her time, and even today she doesn't think much of the speeches delivered by the politicians. If I had been able to guess or know everything back then, I certainly wouldn't have gone to the Broadcasting Corporation or the Propaganda Ministry. For me, Goebbels was a politician who tended to shout a bit loudly. I didn't think about it at all. I also never listened to all that codswallop, his speeches. Everyone was saying the same things. I don't listen to speeches in the Bundestag either. It's all just claptrap, what they come out with. We might be inclined to judge Pomsel's opinion about the speeches in the Bundestag against the background of her experiences, and yet she speaks for a majority of the population. Her perception doesn't just demonstrate resignation towards the present on the part of the older generation, but towards a form of turning away from politics that had been summed up since the 1980s in the term political fatigue, Politikverdrossenheit. This became the word of the year in Germany as early as 1992, and shows another form of ignorance and indifference on the part of the political elite itself, because the voters clearly observed disenchantment with politics did not lead to a change in the actions of politicians. For almost three decades, this detachment from mainstream politics was ignored by the Western elites, and this has now become a dangerous mixture of radicalization on the one hand, and ignorance and political indifference on the other. Far-right attitudes didn't suddenly appear in society, but had been anchored there for a long time, and the only question is what proportion of the population really holds far-right views, since the success of the right can also be explained with reference to a vague mood of protest among the discontented and anxious. They are primarily concerned with giving a sign, a warning to the elites, without supporting the radical demands of the populists. Dangerously, however, they don't question them either. The fury and humiliation have reached a point where facts no longer count. Before we examine whether the democratic elites have themselves failed the voters out of ignorance and indifference, we should examine the socio-economic parallels with the 1930s. In the 1930s, the situation in terms of material conditions as well as the unemployment of large numbers of the population was far more dramatic after the stock market crash of 1929 than it is today. The 2008 crash did not have such devastating effects, yet it created the greatest economic crisis and the worst recession since 1930. And there are fears that the effects of the 2008 financial crisis are still ahead of us in the form of mass unemployment and large-scale social decline. So far, it has been possible to mitigate the impact of the financial crash and the crisis in the euro, but people sense that it could get worse at any time. Today, in parts of the population, even the fear of possible social decline, as in the 1930s, seems to be so powerful that the urge to survive emerges at the expense of social minorities, a fatal reflex that shows how torn society is. This is directly connected with the development of globalization and the economic system that underpins it. Among those who voted for the new right-wing populists, there are some who feel overtaxed by the globalized world, even when they have so far suffered no material disadvantages from it. And yet they despise open borders and the old elites who are untroubled by their concerns. People feel alienated and powerless, according to many analyses by the Western media. The excess of information, which is now digitally available to everyone, intensifies the perception of an excessively complex world and the longing for simple answers. The new bogeymen are the migrants, They too want some security and material comfort, but the protest voters are worried that they themselves will lose out as a result. Such anxieties and subjective emotions, often ignored, may be described as follows. If in Germany a mother of three children who has spent her whole life working feels that she will eventually be reliant on welfare, a problem arises, the feeling of humiliation. When an employee reaches the income level of a refugee, even though he may have paid into the social welfare system for 20 or 30 years, for many, that is an unspeakable injustice. The fact that there may be good reasons why refugees receive state support seems irrelevant to them. They feel only that they are being treated unjustly and their own way of life is under threat. The cause for the lack of interest in facts in favor of a perceived truth, the socio-political process that was described in 2016 as post-truth, lies in wounded feelings, expectations, and incomprehension in the face of an unjust world. But in the end, it may have less to do with factual poverty than with perceived poverty, which in sociological terms is a complex phenomenon, since the feeling depends not only on socio-economic conditions but also on the personal environment of social experiences, social position, and in the end, of worldview. The feeling of injustice seems to encourage a search for a scapegoat and a longing for simple answers. Even Brunhilde Ponsel refers to the humiliation that the Germans felt in the face of defeat in the First World War, which made it so easy for Hitler. Is today's world still not comparable with the 1930s? Then, as now, the collapse did not occur from one day to the next. Misery and rage grew slowly. In the everyday experience of the economic crisis, certain social classes could still live in a relatively carefree way, and what Brunhilde Ponsel describes for the Berlin of the 1930s also applies to post-crash Detroit, Athens, in the wake of austerity politics, or the regions of Germany that face social decline. But while Berlin might have been praised to the skies, it also had its dark sides, and particularly then, after losing the First World War. Unemployed people on every corner, beggars, poor people. Anyone who lived in good areas, as I did, in a good suburb, didn't see any of that. Of course, there were particular areas swarming with poverty and wretchedness. You didn't want to see things like that. You just looked away. Looking away runs through Brunhilde Ponsel's biography like a thread. But in that she wasn't and isn't alone. The democratic parties of the Weimar Republic are often blamed for the collapse of democracy because they lack the courage to assume responsibility and a willingness to cooperate across the party boundaries. The dispute between the parties was more important to them than the solution of the great problems of the time. People in Germany of the 1930s did not look inwards, so they were ignorant of the real and emotionally felt decline of large parts of the population, and in the end they looked away as the supposed enemy of the people was defined, persecuted, and expelled and murdered. Both then and now, upheaval and radicalization were preceded by unhampered globalization. In the 1920s, for many countries, there were no travel restrictions or visa requirements. As in the crash of 1929, speculation on the stock exchange in 2008 had fatal consequences. In both historical situations after the crash, there were a few winners and many losers, although in 2008 these were more perceived than real. However, in both historical situations, masses of people in Europe and the United States had either lost their jobs and were unable to earn a living, or had huge concerns about the future. As in the present day, the forces of globalization, once unleashed, escaped national state control. The political institutions lost their ability to solve problems and a fatal vacuum was created, since the state was no longer able to fulfill its protective function towards its people, and Brunhilde Ponsel stresses that from then on things were easy for Hitler. Attempts were made to mitigate the damage done to financial market capitalism in the present day through economic measures, but in spite of the crisis, bankers' bonuses continued to rise while the monetary policies of the central banks in Europe and the United States gradually devalued life insurance, the purchasing power of pensions, and some other forms of public service. The European governments also undertook serious cuts in the welfare state, and labour market reforms made working relations increasingly precarious. People in the 1930s did not necessarily grasp the complex connections between stock market speculation and the global economic crisis, while today people are kept informed daily about both inequality and the inactivity of politics. Even today, politics seems to be driven by crisis rather than exerting control over a given situation. A hazardous vacuum has been created. In her reflection, Brunhilde Pomsel says of the time before Hitler, "After the end of the First World War, Germany was leaderless. There were no personalities there, and that was why it was so easy for Hitler. Too many unemployed, and they were his whole support." This lack of leadership has also been used by right-wing populists in the present day. For reasons of respect towards the victims of the Second World War, the social conflict and poverty in large parts of the population and inaction on the part of the politicians cannot be directly compared with the present-day situation. Not yet, anyway. But by the end of the 1990s, the fuse for the renewed scenario of a failure of liberal democracy as the result of an unregulated financial industry had been lit in the United States. Since the presidency of Bill Clinton, 1993 to 2001, the Democrats, the left-wing, and liberal forces in the United States, New Labour in the UK, and the Social Democrats of Europe had surrendered to the laws of neoliberal globalization. When the financial markets were deregulated in spite of urgent warnings from leading economists. In Britain, under Tony Blair's government, this led to a policy of social indifference, and under Gerhard Schröder in Germany to Agenda 2010, with massive cuts to the welfare system, a softening of labour market laws, and the weakening of trade unions. The shrinking of the welfare state went hand in hand with an enormous expansion of the financial sector and growth in the low-wage sector. Step by step, the left had betrayed a considerable proportion of their voters, working and lower middle class, some of whom are now being radicalized. What appears more and more clearly is that the ignorance and the inactivity of the democratic elites are responsible for a division in Western societies and have made it so easy for right-wing populists to gain a foothold. Albrecht von Lucke writes that societies are divided into an open liberal metropolitan elite and an increasingly déclassé lower class whose fears of decline radiate upwards more and more powerfully. This leads to a feeling of panic, which has now reached the middle class and made racism socially acceptable. Because of the economic decline of whole population groups in the United States and Europe, as in the 1930s, faith in democracy to intervene with regulations has been weakened. More than that, by spreading conspiracy theories, right-wing forces create the suspicion that the ones at the top want to halt the social decline of large sections of the population. While in Europe, as in the United States, the economic losses were quietly modified by low interest rates and by redirecting tax income to failing banks, the achievements of a social market economy and democracy based on balance and social peace were sacrificed to the neoliberal market ideology. But contemporary neoliberalism did not appear overnight, and it exploited people's faith that globalization would mean an expansion of the social market economy. The opposite occurred, and globalization became the project of the elite and the super-rich. In the 1930s, too, when Brunhilde Pomsel began her career, the same spiral of national isolationism had been set in motion that Donald Trump announced before his elections to the U.S. presidency. Then, too, out of concern about European economic migrants, first of all, only selected foreigners were allowed into the country. In a similar way, Europe's borders are being closed, asylum laws intensified, and the British are about to leave the European Union. In everyday life, the misery of masses of people, as described by Brunhilde Pomsel, is ignored both by the state and by the affluent bourgeoisie. The stock market crash of 1929 was followed by a rightward shift almost everywhere in Europe, just as support for nationalists of all colours has been growing constantly since the financial crisis. This is not happening at random. The leaders of the democratic elites are contributing to the loss of their credibility every day. Revelations about the secret offshore businesses of dozens of heads of state and other wealthy people are regularly published in the media. When the super-rich and large companies take their money to tax havens without paying taxes like everyone else, the inevitable impression is that globalization can no longer be controlled for the benefit of the general population. On the contrary, in fact, these hidden fortunes in the billions grant a small elite of the super-rich an incredible amount of power, in the face of which all government looks powerless, as the journalist Harald Schumann has observed. The entire political class in Europe, including the Greens and even part of the left, has essentially capitulated. They know it is the companies, the banks, and the super-rich who decide on the fortunes of their states, regions, and municipalities. The political parties of the Weimar Republic received a similar judgment. The crisis of democracy is the result, developed over a long period of time, of helpless-looking politicians who saw no alternative to the rescue of the banks after the financial crisis, which was seen as capitulation by both the left and the right wings. Many in these groups reject globalization while the political elite capitulates to the greed of the financial industry and right-wing populists exploit the fury and despair of the population for their own purposes. In the West, a fragmented society no longer forms a unified community. The sovereignty of the European democratic elites and parties is now vanishing since they have shown themselves, or at least given the impression, as being incapable of serving the common good. As in the 1930s, the appeal of the populists lies in the promise of supposedly simple solutions. But simple solutions are extremely dangerous because it is much more difficult to change them than it is to let them come into being. Terrorism, debt crisis, climate change, refugees. These problems can no longer be solved at a national level, and yet more and more people are following this reflex of simplification. The moderate middle class of the bourgeoisie seems now, as then, primarily preoccupied with itself. Personal challenges are now oscillating between family and career in a flexible labor market. The model follows that of the American dream, which since the financial crisis has been revealed as a nightmare. Everyone is responsible for himself. The social network becomes ever more fragmented, and the overriding emotion is not freedom but insecurity. What still seemed certain to the generation of baby boomers, that they could work their way up through their own efforts, is no longer valid either in the United States or in Europe. The advantages of Western capitalism have become so fragile that many people are questioning the purpose of democracy, in which companies and the wealthy are so much better off than individual citizens. Here, populists on both left and right find many ways of breaking down social cohesion. What has long been heralded is now becoming reality. The people promising salvation have reappeared. As Brunhilde Pomser remembers the period immediately after Hitler's rise to power. But immediately after Hitler's accession, the mood was simply one of new hope. It was still a huge surprise that Hitler had done it. I think they were surprised themselves. Are Western societies today, out of egoism on the one hand and ignorance and indifference towards the populace on the other, stumbling blindly into a new nightmare? One other mobilizing factor is the indifference, even mockery, from the liberal democratic elites towards the groups voting for right-wing parties, which hardly contributes to a solution. Elisabeth Rether explains in a remarkable essay in Die Zeit that with their arrogance, the liberal elites have themselves become part of the crisis, while the so-called left-behind voting classes want to take their revenge on the ones at the top. Those groups of the population with college degrees and a more or less secure job despise those without these advantages for not being so tolerant towards immigrants and other minorities. On the other hand, graduate jobs are not potentially threatened by immigrants, and employed graduates are not afraid of competition for social services. The potential losers in globalization are standing outside our labor exchanges, just as the refugees stand outside our borders. The refugees and right-wing populists should remind us that our effort to achieve a better world are failing before our eyes. Part of the task of democratic parties is to take the fury of the voters and uncomfortable truths seriously when they are delivered, for example, in the form of survey results that reflect the mood in the population. When researchers at the University of Leipzig established in 2016, for example, that half of all Germans sometimes feel like foreigners in their own country because of the many Muslims living there, and 41% think Muslims should be banned from coming to Germany from the outset, this refers to a part of the population much larger as a percentage than those who have so far voted for the right-wing AfD. To deny or repress this insecurity and discontent in the population is much more dangerous than to conduct a public debate about a general limitation on immigration. If such opinions become deeply rooted and in the end half of the population refuses further migration, one cannot simply dismiss them out of hand. If bourgeois forces do not face the fear and potential radicalization of a population, and if governments do not invest in combating the reasons for refugees fleeing to other countries in the first place, then they should be honest and get to the heart of the price of isolationism, infringement of human rights, international law, and militarized border facilities. A study by the British Opinion Poll Institute Ipsos Mori shows that the Germans, like almost all other citizens in Europe and the United States, are completely wrong in their assessment of the supposed flood of Muslim migrants. 1 in 5 people living in Germany, or 21% of the country's population, is of Muslim faith, the respondents estimated. In fact, it is only 1 in 20, or 5% of the population as a whole, and that is after the big wave of refugees in 2015. Even today, it is not clear how many people will return to Syria after the end of the civil war, which would further reduce the proportion of Muslims in the population. This misapprehension is even clearer in the United States, where the proportion is 1% as against an estimated 17%. A society can overcome the brutalization of the modern age only if it has a reliable framework for order outside of nationalist and isolationist policy, and unmasks the populists and their completely unrealistic promises as well as their lies. Only if all democratic forces manage to engage objectively with the facts rather than being guided by emotions can the increase in numbers moving to the right-wing populists be halted. For this to happen, the social problems and dislocations of neoliberal capitalism, the financial and economic crisis, the parallels with the 1930s set out here, must first be taken seriously. There could be a good side to the rise of the right-wing populists, because hitherto socio-political issues were not on the agenda of the elites. At the last meeting of the G20 states in September 2016, the governments of the 20 largest industrial nations declared that the advantages of globalization must be more widely distributed. Perhaps this plan even went into action because the elites feared a return to the 1930s, and if this is the case, then there is a chance of reform in globalization. Moreover, it is not clear that the moderate bourgeoisie will be content to simply watch the rise of the right-wing populists from afar. There is a chance that the election of Trump, the close election result in Austria, the dismantling of democracy in Poland and Hungary, Brexit and the situation in Turkey and Syria, as well as the general brutalization of Western democracies, were a final warning for the elections in France, the Netherlands, and Germany. The emphasis is on chance, because the enemies of democracy are still storming the parliaments. Equally, out of sheer fear and ignorance, we are obviously standing under the bell jar described by Brunhilde Pomse, in which a general obsession with personal advantage, along with opportunism and denial of the current social situation, continue to aid the rise of the right-wing populists. Perhaps those who lived through the Nazi regime could plead a lack of knowledge. But we know the course of history, and should know better. It will be a long and difficult battle to repel the right-wing populists and above all to win back their voters for a democratic constitutional state and for European unity, which will involve engaging with the demands of those groups of voters who are turning away from democracy. More liberal demands for tolerance and the protection of minorities will not succeed alone. It will also require measures that, after the terrorist attacks in Europe in 2015 and 2016, will create a feeling of security. That refugees must officially register and the state must be in a position to filter out dangerous individuals and other criminals is obvious from a constitutional point of view. But this must be done in spite of the shrill demands for expulsion, isolationism, and other repressive measures on the part of the right-wing populists, without endangering the human rights of refugees fleeing civil wars and migrants in general. We citizens must show moral courage in defending these rights, even in everyday life. We must not forget that one of the most important lessons from the failed refugee policy of the international community in the 1930s and 40s concerned the rejection of Jewish refugees, since no worldwide agreement could be reached on taking them in. In 1937, when growing persecution caused a mass flight of the Jewish population, there was barely a country that allowed unlimited immigration. When the Nazi regime at last forbade all emigration in October 1941, it was almost impossible for the Jews who had stayed in the German Reich to flee annihilation. It wasn't until after the Second World War that binding agreements were reached for the protection of refugees in the form of a treaty that still applies today, the 1951 Geneva Convention on Refugees. It obliges us to never send people in search of protection back to where they are threatened by persecution. The demands for secure borders and social justice are therefore not demands that a democratic society should leave to right-wing populists, who in any case questioned the international legal principle of the Geneva Convention, and certainly not when at the core of their mostly simplified analysis there may be a kernel of truth. But neither in the past nor in the present day have right-wing populists of every type even begun to prove that they were in a position to solve problems peacefully, humanely, or permanently. Almost without exception, their power has been exerted at the expense of minorities, with chaos, violence, power, and oppression. Populists are generally inclined to make completely unrealistic promises, but as soon as they are in power, the discrepancy between claims and reality often becomes apparent. There are plenty of examples from recent history that show that right-wing populist governments generally go in one of two directions. Either the interests of the voters are turned into their opposite, or internal disputes lead to the collapse of the party. Brunhilde Pomsel isn't the only very elderly eyewitness to fascism to have asked whether people have learned from history. The doctor Ingeborg Rapaport, who died at the age of 104, experienced several times what it means to be persecuted. What united her and Brunhilde Pomsel was fear of the new rabble-rousing spirit in Germany in 2016. Ingeborg Rapaport became famous at the age of 102 when she became the oldest person in the world to gain a doctorate. She was born in 1912 in Cameroon, a German colony at the time, grew up in Hamburg, and, as a Jew, fled from the Nazis with her mother to the United States. From there, having been denounced as a communist, she had to flee again during the McCarthy era to the GDR, where she later experienced the fall of the Berlin Wall. In an interview like Brunhilde Pomsel, she describes her own apolitical attitude up to the point when she found herself confronting anti-Semitism in Nazi Germany as a young woman. She remembers an atmosphere of omnipresent fear. The anti-Semitism she would later encounter in the GDR was only latent, but with reunification it came back into the open. The fact that a xenophobic movement like Pegida should have established itself in East Germany of all places was a great source of concern to her. Every day she listened to the news and took a keen interest in what was happening in the country. The burning of refugee hostels, demonstrators shouting "Germany for the Germans," and spreading fear. She was familiar with all this because fear was the most important instrument of the Nazis. The way people talk about refugees today stirred bad memories in Ingeborg Rapaport. She saw the greatest danger as radicalization on the one hand and political indifference on the other. The apolitical are easy to influence. The dangerous ones are those who want simple answers to complex questions, she said. She believed in peace-loving people with a sense of solidarity and not in the ego-driven capitalist system. The derogatory discussion of Islam and the debate around the full-faced veil were used, in her view, as a way of stirring up hatred, just like the things she experienced in National Socialism. In the end, both biographies have one thing in common. Brunhilde Pomsel and Ingeborg Rapaport are perhaps the last warning of a generation that experienced firsthand what fascism, ignorance, passivity, and opportunism have done in Germany and the world. The bourgeoisie of the 1920s and 1930s at first despised Adolf Hitler as an idiot and were silent until it was too late. Brunhilde Pomsel, by her own retrospective account, was blind in her quest for success and affluence and indifferent towards the developments of her time. We too are clearly too lethargic these days to implement the obvious solution, to try to help the disadvantaged in our system have a greater share. New liberalism, in its present-day form, has sacrificed social solidarity in favor of narcissistic individuality. Everyone forges his own destiny. Not by chance is that saying a symbol of the American dream, which was revealed by the final crisis of 2008 as creating many, many losers, and in the end, President Donald Trump. Solidarity is the oil in the engine of a democratic, free, and humanistic society. If we want to go on putting up with the injustice of an economic system that over the past few years has increasingly fostered disunity to maximize the profits of multinational companies, we are feeding the right-wing populists. A slow breakdown of solidarity is always followed by dehumanization. A society in which human instincts such as empathy and solidarity are repressed is such an ugly society that it actually ceases to need democracy. Brunhilde Pomsel's selfish and unreflecting efforts to secure her own advantage are currently taking place a million times over in ourselves. If democracy bends so deeply to the economy that people think they no longer have any influence on institutions, and even see their interest as being betrayed, then the populists and fascists will have an easy ride over the years to come. The former US Secretary of State Henry Kissinger encapsulates the historical experience in Germany in a single breath. We in America must understand that you cannot continually offend the social